Nemoto Presents Addiction, Adolescence at Risk. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 26 minutes. Adolescence and early adulthood represent a developmental window in which vulnerability to addiction increases for reasons grounded in biology, psychology, and social context. The pattern remains consistent with the wider thesis. Addiction is a human condition rather than a property of a drug. Substances and behaviors differ, but the process is recognizable. Relief from stress or emptiness is discovered. Repetition trains attention and routines. Alternatives atrophy. Necessity replaces choice. In this stage of life, sensitivity to reward is high, self-regulation is still developing, sleep is irregular, and belonging carries extraordinary weight. Environments saturated with high-potency products and instantaneous digital access add pressure to systems that are not yet fully mature. Understanding these dynamics allows families, schools, clinics, and public agencies to design supports that reduce harm and increase the probability of ordinary, stable life. Neurodevelopment establishes the backdrop. During adolescence, the brain's reward networks exhibit heightened responsiveness to novelty and social cues. The prefrontal systems responsible for planning, inhibitory control, and long-term evaluation continue to mature into the mid-20s. This mismatch between strong incentive signals and still consolidating control mechanisms does not imply defect. It describes normal development. It explains why peers and immediate consequences exert greater influence at this age than abstract future risks. Sleep patterns also shift. Circadian rhythms delay, pushing natural sleep later, while school schedules often demand early rising. Chronic sleep restriction magnifies impulsivity, emotional reactivity, and risk-taking, and it increases vulnerability to self-medication with stimulants, sedatives, alcohol, or cannabis. These features of development intersect with social realities to shape exposure and response. Social context exerts decisive force. Adolescents and emerging adults often move through environments where supervision decreases while expectations increase. Academic pressure, financial insecurity, family conflict, and unstable housing amplify stress. Digital platforms compress social comparison into a constant stream, intensifying perceived inadequacy and fear of exclusion. Local markets deliver substances with a speed that outpaces traditional prevention strategies. In this setting, early experimentation may progress to patterns that impair school, work, relationships, and health before warning signs are recognized. Epidemiological patterns vary across regions, but the initial exposures most commonly involve alcohol, nicotine, cannabis, and diverted prescription medications. Vaping technologies deliver nicotine in forms that reduce immediate aversive sensations and increase uptake, promoting rapid habituation. Cannabis products in many communities contain higher concentrations of psychoactive compounds than in prior decades, altering risk profiles for anxiety, psychosis in predisposed individuals, and cognitive impacts on attention and memory. Non-medical use of prescription stimulants, sedatives, and opioids appears along multiple pathways. Exam stress, post-injury pain, insomnia, and access through peers and family medicine cabinets. Counterfeit tablets that resemble legitimate medications introduce additional danger when potency or composition is unknown. These supply characteristics turn experimentation into a higher risk activity than in earlier generations, independent of any change in adolescent psychology. Risk is not distributed evenly. Youth experiencing family instability, exposure to violence, foster care placement, homelessness, or discrimination carry higher baseline stress. LGBTQ+ youth often navigate rejection or concealment that increases isolation and depression. Adolescents with neurodevelopmental differences may struggle with impulse control, sensory regulation, or social understanding in ways that heighten exposure to risky settings or self-medication attempts. Communities with limited access to mental health care, primary care, safe recreation, and living wage employment accumulate pressures that increase the probability of substance use progressing to a disorder. These gradients reflect systemic factors and require system-level responses, not only individual admonitions. Clinical practice adapted for this age group recognizes confidentiality as foundational. Adolescents are more likely to disclose substance use and mental health concerns when assured that information will be protected within legal limits. Minor consent statutes vary by jurisdiction, but many regions allow confidential access to certain services, including substance use counseling and specific medical treatments. Effective programs explain the boundaries clearly at the outset: what will remain private, what must be shared for safety, and how guardians will be engaged when consent is required or when risk crosses established thresholds. This clarity establishes trust and reduces avoidance of care. It also supports responsible inclusion of caregivers when appropriate, aligning support at home with treatment goals. Screening should be universal, brief, and respectful. Tools tailored for adolescents identify patterns ranging from experimentation to hazardous use and disorder. Screening succeeds when embedded in routine visits and school-based services rather than reserved for moments of crisis. Questions should be concrete, non-judgmental, and linked to immediate options, not lectures. Positive screens prompt action plans that match severity, education, and monitoring for low-risk cases, brief interventions for moderate risk, and referral to structured treatment for high risk or impaired functioning. The transition from screening to action needs to be immediate. Waiting lists and complex referral processes lose momentum and increase exposure to a dangerous supply. Psychosocial treatments are central. Motivational approaches respect ambivalence and explore discrepancies between stated values and current behavior without moral pressure. Cognitive and behavioral methods teach recognition of triggers, skillful refusal, emotion regulation, and problem solving. Contingency management uses immediate, tangible reinforcement to strengthen attendance and goal behaviors, a method well suited to adolescent reward systems. Family-based therapies address interaction patterns that maintain problems and reorganize roles toward clear expectations and reliable support. These methods do not require perfection to produce benefit. They require repetition across weeks and months, delivered by staff trained to remain calm, predictable, and direct. Medications have roles that should be considered case by case. For opioid use disorder, maintenance therapies reduce mortality and improve retention even in younger populations when thoughtfully implemented with appropriate consent and monitoring. For alcohol use disorder, medications that reduce reward or block receptors can support reduction or abstinence when combined with counseling and social supports. For co-occurring depression, anxiety, or attention deficit syndromes, psychopharmacology may reduce drivers of self-medication and improve engagement with non-pharmacologic therapies. Prescribing must account for developmental considerations, family dynamics, and the capacity for adherence. Abrupt discontinuation policies for long-term medications prescribed in earlier stages of care should be avoided. Tapering requires pacing and alternative supports to prevent destabilization. Co-occurring conditions are the rule rather than the exception. Depressive disorders, anxiety disorders, trauma-related syndromes, learning differences, and attention deficit/hyperactivity presentations require integrated assessment and treatment. Serial referrals that bounce a student between separate services discourage continuity and weaken outcomes. Integrated teams align schedules, share information with consent, and coordinate messaging so that advice does not conflict across domains. When sleep is corrected, mood improves. When mood improves, craving declines. When craving declines, attendance at school and appointments improves. These interactions demonstrate why fragmented systems fail and integrated systems succeed. Sleep merits direct attention. Delayed circadian rhythm, early school start times, and late-night digital engagement leave many adolescents chronically sleep-deprived. Sleep restriction intensifies impulsivity, reduces tolerance for frustration, and increases reliance on substances to alter state. Practical steps include education about sleep timing, reduction of late evening light exposure, and routines that shift activities earlier. School systems considering later start times for older students align policy with neurobiology, reducing daytime sleepiness and improving attention. Sleep is not a side note, it is a modifiable determinant of risk. Digital access changes the landscape of exposure, transaction, and reinforcement. Social platforms connect buyers and sellers rapidly, and encrypted messaging reduces friction between impulse and acquisition. Counterfeit pills can move through friend networks and arrive at private gatherings with little visibility to adults. Prevention programs that ignore these realities underperform. Effective strategies teach recognition of counterfeit risk, emphasize that appearance does not guarantee composition, and normalize help seeking when uncertainty arises. Digital tools also provide opportunities: telehealth for counseling, secure messaging for appointment reminders, online peer groups moderated by clinicians, and applications that cue skills practice or connect to crisis lines. Technology is neutral. Design and incentives determine whether it accelerates harm or help. Athletics and injury constitute a specific pathway for exposure to opioids and sedatives. Post-injury pain management should prioritize multimodal strategies and conservative prescribing, with clear instructions for storage and disposal. Return-to-play decisions should incorporate mental health screening given the psychological impact of lost seasons and identity disruption. Athletic departments can coordinate with clinics to provide education on medication risks and to establish protocols for referral when concerns arise. Performance pressure intersects with stimulant misuse in some cohorts. Alternatives that address sleep, time management, and study skills reduce reliance on non-medical stimulant use as a coping strategy. Campus environments require tailored policies. Residential colleges and technical institutes benefit from clear Good Samaritan protections that encourage calls during intoxication or overdose without fear of punitive consequences for the caller or the person in distress. Campus health centers should offer walk-in access to addiction assessment, same-day initiation of indicated medications, and rapid referral to community partners for services not available on campus. Resident staff should be trained to recognize overdose and to administer naloxone. Student conduct processes should distinguish between violent or predatory behavior, which warrants enforcement, and substance-related illness, which warrants care pathways. Aligning conduct policy with health goals reduces secrecy and improves safety. Harm reduction applies to adolescents and emerging adults in age-appropriate forms. Naloxone training for peers, education on rescue breathing, and widespread availability of reversal agents reduce deaths. Instruction on avoiding solitary use, recognizing signs of overdose, and contacting emergency services without delay converts bystanders into first responders. Drug checking resources, where lawful, provide information about supply composition and can deter use when danger is confirmed. Messaging should be practical, unembellished, and specific to local patterns. Shock tactics attract attention but undermine credibility. Credibility, not fear, changes behavior. Families require concrete tools rather than generalized lectures. Safe storage of medications eliminates a common source of diversion. Disposal of unused prescriptions reduces the stock available for experimentation. Regular, calm discussions about substance use that focus on safety and decision-making outperform sporadic confrontations. Boundaries about curfew, guests, transportation, and finances should be explicit and consistent. Families benefit from access to counseling that models de-escalation, teaches scripts for difficult conversations, and clarifies when to seek external help. Caregivers also need respite and support. Caregiver fatigue fuels conflict that worsens outcomes. Schools form the spine of adolescent life and can integrate prevention, screening, and support. Health education should move beyond slogans to include skills for emotion regulation, recognition of exploitation and coercion, sleep hygiene, and media literacy. Screening for substance use and depression can occur within school health services, with confidential referrals to community partners. Staff should be trained to respond to disclosures without judgment and to connect students to appropriate care rapidly. Zero tolerance policies that result in suspension or expulsion for possession or intoxication often increase risk by removing structure and connection. Alternative responses keep students engaged while addressing safety and health directly. Justice systems hold leverage that should be used for stabilization rather than churn. Deflection at the point of police contact routes eligible cases to services instead of detention. Prosecutorial diversion that emphasizes rapid entry to counseling and medication reduces recidivism compared with sanction-heavy monitoring. Juvenile courts benefit from integrated clinical teams that assess needs beyond the legal charge and that coordinate schooling, housing, and family support. Records related to adolescent possession and intoxication should be sealable to prevent long-term barriers to employment and education when treatment succeeds. Enforcement remains necessary for violence and exploitation. Illness requires care. Housing stability is foundational. Adolescents experiencing homelessness or housing insecurity encounter elevated risks of exploitation, violence, and infectious disease. Housing First models for young people provide safety without abstinence preconditions and connect residents to schooling, employment services, and healthcare. For students living at home, household instability still disrupts treatment adherence, sleep, and nutrition. Social services that address utilities, food security, and caregiver employment contribute indirectly but powerfully to reduced substance-related harm. Measurement keeps systems honest. Programs serving adolescents should track access to first appointments, time to first dose for indicated medications, retention at 30, 90, and 180 days, school attendance, graduation or credential attainment, emergency department utilization, hospital admissions, housing stability, and family reunification where applicable. Data must be disaggregated by age, gender, race, language, and geography to identify inequities. Risk adjustment is necessary so that programs treating higher acuity youth are not penalized for case mix. Transparent dashboards guide course corrections and build public trust. Equity requires deliberate design. Youth from marginalized communities often encounter barriers at each step. Fewer clinics nearby, fewer clinicians trained in adolescent addiction care, lower access to telehealth due to broadband limits, and greater exposure to punitive school and policing practices. Corrective actions include establishing services within neighborhoods, hiring staff from those communities, providing language access, ensuring transportation support, and revising disciplinary policies that disproportionately affect particular groups. Equity reviews should occur regularly and lead to documented adjustments. Workforce readiness determines capacity. Clinicians require training in adolescent development, trauma-informed practice, motivational methods, and family therapies. Peers with near-age experience can be powerful supports when trained and supervised. Case managers must know housing systems, education pathways, and benefits eligibility specific to young people. Outreach workers need safety protocols and field kits that include naloxone, wound care supplies, and information on shelters and clinics. Compensation and career ladders reduce turnover that otherwise disrupts continuity just when stability matters most. Public communication should avoid spectacle and provide service. Campaigns that show where to obtain naloxone, how to identify counterfeit pills, how to access same-day clinical care, and what protections exist under Good Samaritan policies produce measurable benefits. Media coverage that links overdose clusters to practical steps rather than sensational imagery helps families and peers act quickly. Messaging should be updated as local supply changes. Vague warnings dull response. Specific information prompts action. Prevention that aligns with development emphasizes skills more than threats. Programs that teach refusal skills, distress tolerance, conflict resolution, and time management prepare students for predictable pressures. Practice matters. Role plays, coaching, and feedback convert knowledge into behavior. Partnerships with youth organizations, sports leagues, arts programs, and faith communities extend protective routines beyond the classroom. Availability of safe, engaging spaces after school reduces idle intervals where risk rises. Small design choices, open gym hours, music rooms, maker spaces, staff study halls, create alternative rewards that compete with substance use. Transition points require special attention. Moves from middle to high school to college or work, and home to independent living create gaps in supervision, community, and routine. Systems should anticipate these transitions and prearrange continuity, transferring care between clinics, providing lists of campus and community resources, ensuring that medications are available without interruption, and establishing contact persons who check in during the first weeks. Without these steps, progress made in one setting evaporates in the next. Medical crises are opportunities for redirection. After overdose reversal, an immediate warm handoff to a clinic that can start medication within 24 to 48 hours improves survival. After hospitalization for infection or injury, addiction consultation services can initiate treatment, address pain management without destabilization, and coordinate post-discharge follow-up. Pediatric and adolescent inpatient units can include addiction specialists who work with families to align care plans and clarify safety steps at home. Each contact becomes a bridge rather than an isolated event. Ethics and rights must be explicit. Adolescents are entitled to care that respects autonomy within legal limits, that explains risks and benefits plainly, and that safeguards privacy. Withholding medications as punishment for lapses increases harm and contradicts clinical standards. Involuntary holds should be reserved for imminent danger and paired with rapid transition to voluntary care as soon as possible. Consent processes should include both adolescents and caregivers when appropriate, with clear documentation of decisions and contingencies. Economic and labor policies intersect with risk. Regions without entry-level jobs that pay living wages force young adults into informal economies where exposure to violence and substance use is higher. Apprenticeships, paid internships, and short-cycle credential programs aligned with treatment schedules transform stabilization into routine. Employers who adopt fair chance hiring and provide structured support for employees in recovery reduce turnover and contribute to community stability. Economic opportunity is not a substitute for treatment, but treatment without opportunity stalls at the threshold. Cultural narratives influence uptake of services. Communities that celebrate only abstinence may exclude those not ready for that path and lose lives to a contaminated supply. Communities that focus solely on survival may miss the possibility of academic achievement, employment, and family stability after stabilization. Balanced narratives recognize success as a pattern of days, medications taken as prescribed when indicated, appointments kept, school or work attended, conflicts handled without violence, and relationships repaired after harm. These narratives invite participation rather than performance. Special populations benefit from tailored approaches. Pregnant adolescents require integrated obstetric and addiction care that avoids punitive reflexes and supports healthy parenting. Adolescents in foster care require continuity across placements and after-hours access to services. Youth returning from detention require bridge prescriptions, transportation to clinics, identification documents, and assistance with school re-enrollment. LGBTQ+ adolescents require clinicians trained in affirming care to reduce minority stress that drives self-medication. College students require campus community agreements that allow immediate transfer between levels of care without restarting intake at each step. Operational details determine outcomes. Clinics promising walk-in access must staff that access. Telehealth offerings must include after-school and evening hours. Pharmacies dispensing medications for opioid use disorder must coordinate with clinics to prevent gaps. Schools offering screening must have referral partners with capacity. Outreach teams must maintain predictable schedules and communicate them in places adolescents actually see. Data dashboards must update on a schedule and be accessible on mobile devices. Each element appears mundane, but the absence of any one of them becomes a point of failure through which lives fall. The overarching frame remains consistent. Addiction in adolescence and early adulthood is one expression of a human condition that seeks relief under pressure. Drugs and behaviors are vehicles. Context provides the fuel and the terrain. Systems that respect development, protect confidentiality, integrate care, and provide alternatives change trajectories. Systems that rely on fear, delay access, fragment services, and punish illness magnify harm. The difference is visible in metrics that matter. Fewer funerals, more diplomas, more stable leases, more steady jobs, and more families who experience disagreements without crisis. A practical blueprint emerges from these observations. Establish adolescent-friendly clinics with same-day access and clear confidentiality practices. Embed screening and brief interventions in schools and primary care. Train staff across sectors to respond without judgment and to connect immediately to care. Saturate communities with naloxone and credible information about local supply risks. Provide housing options that do not require abstinence as a precondition. Align campus policies with health goals and Good Samaritan protections. Build economic pathways that allow stabilized young adults to move into roles that structure time and identity. Fund measurement and publish results. Adjust quickly when data show gaps. In the end, effective adolescent addiction care looks like ordinary competence spread across many small tasks repeated reliably. Text reminders go out. Buses arrive. Clinic doors open when the sign says they will. Phones are answered. Appointments are available at times that match school and work. Medications are dispensed without unnecessary barriers. Families receive scripts rather than scolding. Schools offer skills, not slogans. Police direct eligible cases to care instead of court. Judges seal records when treatment milestones are met. Employers retain talent with clear plans. Neighborhoods know where to go for help. The subject remains serious. The response becomes equally serious. That response honors a simple fact. Adolescents and emerging adults grow into stability when the surrounding systems behave predictably, respectfully, and at speed. The goal is not an absence of appetite or error. The goal is fewer deaths and more ordinary days in which school, work, family, and sleep proceed without being arranged around a substance. When communities build toward that outcome, addiction loses ground. When communities fail to build, the supply fills the space left empty. The choice is visible in the routines of a city, a campus, or a county that has decided to treat addiction as the human condition it is, and to design accordingly.